From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. While Henry Ford was putting Americans on the road with his Model T, he was preaching anti-Semitism. He used the newspaper he owned to publish excerpts of the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, which purported to be the minutes of a meeting of Jewish conspirators plotting to take over the world. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Neil Baldwin, author of Henry Ford and the Jews, The Mass Production of Hate. Also, TV critic David Bianculli reviews Mark Twain, the new documentary by Ken Burns, which airs on PBS stations tonight and tomorrow. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A second group of prisoners from Afghanistan has arrived at the U.S. military base at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. A base spokesman said the prisoners are getting medical exams and moving into a high-security holding facility. NPR's Tom Gelton reports from the Pentagon.
Pentagon officials say the Afghanistan fighters who've been moved to Guantanamo are very dangerous people, so high security measures are warranted. The detainees are being kept in 6-foot by 8-foot open-air cells surrounded by chain-link fences. Some human rights groups say the cells are more like cages and charge that the detention does not meet minimum international standards. Pentagon spokeswoman Victoria Clark says the detainees being housed at Guantanamo are being treated humanely.
They are receiving culturally appropriate meals every day. They are getting showers every day. They are getting medical treatment. They are given an opportunity to exercise.
Clark says a delegation from the International Committee of the Red Cross is due to visit the Guantanamo detainees later this week. Tom Gelton, NPR News, The Pentagon.
Colombia's government and its largest rebel group have agreed to resume peace talks after a tense standoff. A group of foreign diplomats and a UN representative announced the agreement, which was reached after the diplomats met with rebels in their safe zone, an area that was set aside when peace talks began in 1998. The agreement came just before a deadline set by the government. The co-founder of Global Relief Foundation, an Islamic charity targeted by the U.S. government, has been transferred from the custody of immigration officials to the custody of U.S. marshals. The government won't say why, but his lawyers say they think their client is really being held to investigate the charity, not a visa violation. NPR's Libby Lewis reports.
Rabi Haddad was taken into custody by immigration agents on December 14th. That was hours after other government agents raided the offices of Global Relief outside Chicago and froze its assets. The government says it has credible evidence that Global Relief supports terrorist activities, but it won't release it. Lawyer Noel Sala said he can only guess at what's going on with his client because the government won't tell him anything.
I think it's much more likely that there is a grand jury in investigating the Global Relief Foundation in Chicago, and it's likely that Rabi Haddad was subpoenaed and taken to appear before that grand jury.
He said he may have to file a constitutional claim just to see his client. Libby Lewis, NPR News, Chicago.
President Bush kept up his campaign for an economic stimulus package today during stops in the Midwest. He told workers at a John Deere farm equipment factory in Moline, Illinois, that he wants to open foreign markets to American goods. In stocks, the Dow lost 96 points to close at 9,891. The Nasdaq lost 31 points, or 1.5%. The S&P 500 lost 7. This is NPR News. The United Nations is calling on international donor nations to make good on their promises of financial aid to Afghanistan. A UN spokesman said the Afghan government needs immediate cash to pay police and government workers. He said that although donor companies promised $20 million in aid at a conference in Bonn, Germany, so far only $2 million has been provided. The spokesman praised Pakistan for its promise of $100 million in aid to help rebuild Afghanistan. The radio home of the Grand Ole Opry will stay country. WSM-AM in Nashville has broadcast the Opry since 1925, but its owners had been considering a format change to all sports. Anita Bug reports from member station WPLN in Nashville.
After hundreds of calls, emails, a rally, and even the threat of physical violence by country legend George Jones, WSM-AM owner Gaylord Entertainment relented. Company CEO Colin Reed now says country music and the Opry will stay on the historic station.
But what it came down to for us is that we're not dealing with a conventional radio station. And rating formulas don't always take into account the chemistry and the heritage and the loyalty of our listeners. And judging by the amount of people who have called and emailed me over the last 2 weeks, self-professed AM listeners, the ratings may be wrong.
Reed says Gaylord Entertainment will now seek to syndicate the Grand Ole Opry. The country music show hasn't been in syndication since 1957. For NPR News, I'm Anita Bug in Nashville.
A mobile health clinic has been set up in Manhattan to provide free medical exams to workers cleaning debris from buildings near the World Trade Center. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Kresge Foundation, building capacity with challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When a person preaches extreme anti-Semitism and sees Jews as the center of an international financial conspiracy, you might presume this person is uneducated, unsophisticated, and easily duped. So how do you explain Henry Ford, one of America's greatest industrialists? While he was building the Ford Motor Company and putting America on the road with his Model T, he was also publishing excerpts of the anti-Semitic book The Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. In fact, Hitler became one of Ford's admirers. My guest Neil Baldwin is the author of the new book Henry Ford and the Jews, The Mass Production of Hate. Baldwin is the author of earlier biographies of Thomas Alva Edison and William Carlos Williams. He's also executive director of the National Book Foundation, which sponsors the National Book Awards. Let's start with the most anti-Semitic things that Ford was responsible for. In 1918, he bought the Dearborn Independent, which was a small paper that he turned into a vehicle for anti-Semitism. What did he do with the paper?
The Dearborn Independent was a tiny little country newspaper in Dearbornville, Michigan, and Henry Ford decided that he needed a platform for his views. And he hired very, very top editorial talent from the Detroit News to help edit and run the newspaper, and began to publish a weekly paper. The first 6 months of the Dearborn Independent were very lively. It was kind of like an all-purpose, feature-oriented publication. There were articles about women's issues, and there was poetry in the newspaper. There was articles from overseas, photo spreads, all kinds of interesting things. But starting about 6 months into the newspaper, the tenor changed, and Ford began to use it as a platform for his anti-Semitic views, and he published over the next 2 years, 1920 through 1922, he published an article every single week vilifying the Jewish people in one way or another. So he proceeded to transform the newspaper from an all-around weekly news sheet into an anti-Semitic screed.
In 1920, he started publishing a series in the Dearborn Independent called The International Jew, The World's Problem. This ran for 91 weeks, this series. What kind of information did he print in this series?
What happened was he had a lieutenant who was the general manager of the Independent, whose name was E.G. Liebold, who was of Prussian-German descent. And Mr. Liebold was a self-styled scholar of anti-Semitism, and he began to assemble a complete library of anti-Jewish literature going back to the 17th century, and Ford gave him a budget, actually, to acquire these works. And at some point in the early 1920, Liebold met a Russian emigre named Boris Brassel, who was an anti-Tsarist who had come to this country to spread the word of anti-Bolshevism. And Brassel had a transcript of the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, which is probably the single most harmful anti-Jewish tract ever created. It was it was a forgery that had roots in turn-of-the-century Russia around the time of the first Zionist Congress, actually. And it was purportedly, the protocols is another word for minutes, it was purportedly the minutes of a worldwide gathering of the high rabbis gathering in outside Prague, at the cemetery of Prague, to discuss their plan for world domination. And Bresol was able to get a copy of this into the hands of Liebold. And this tract was serialized in the Dearborn Independent, kind of like each article that attacked a different aspect of the Jewish problem or the Jewish question had an epigraph from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, kind of before the lead paragraph to set the tone for whatever criticism of the Jews was being put forth.
What were some of the main points that the Protocols made about the Jews?
Ford personally resonated so well with the Protocols of the Elders of Zion because the main kind of the informing theme of the Protocols was world domination through financial means. The major theme of the Protocols is we, being the Jewish people, the Jewish race, as it was called at that time, are going to infiltrate the banks, and we are going to become the wire pullers of the world economy. We are going to become the government behind the government. The way that we are going to subvert the world rulership is through the economic system. And Ford accepted this wholeheartedly because he was so inherently defensive anyway about the Eastern banking establishment and about Wall Street and about the international bankers, the Rothschilds, and the, you know, he had all these generic terms for the, he even thought of J.P. Morgan as part of that that group, and he felt very, very threatened by the banking system. This came to a head, actually, very early on. I've been able to pinpoint 1907, 1908, when Paul Warburg, who was a very prominent German-Jewish banker, came to this country, immigrated to this country, and he published an essay in the New York Times in November of 1907, and which he advocated a central banking system for America, which was actually the prototype for the what became the Federal Reserve System. And he was basing this upon a paradigm that existed already in German and other Western European banks. And Ford really did not like this at all. This kind of segued perfectly into his paranoid belief that the Jews were actually, this was part of the whole movement to take over the American banking system in a similar sense to the way he believed they were taking over other countries. So the root cause of Ford's anti-Semitism, I do believe, is financial.
Can you talk a little bit about the conspiratorial language that was used in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion?
Well, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion were written, as I've sort of been implying, they were written in the first person plural. The whole premise of it is that someone was at this secret meeting of these chief rabbis from all around the world, and someone was taking notes and writing down exactly what they were saying. And they kind of took each dimension of society and each dimension of culture in order. So they first discussed the banks, then they discussed another sore spot with Ford, which was the concept of Jews as warmongers. So it would say something like, we are going to instigate the governments of European countries to go to war against each other so that we can then weaken their infrastructure and take over control. The word control was a tremendous buzzword throughout the Protocols. And again, you have this sense of solidarity. There's a whole other subtext in the Protocols about, which actually sort of in Ford's view, paved the way for the Zionist movement, because there's this other section about we are going to establish a country especially for ourselves in Zion, and we will call this country, you know, we will call this country Zion, and we will encourage all Jews to pay homage to this country and to gravitate there, and then we will establish the seat of our world government there. So there's all this kind of sense of solidarity and Jews as one entity, one consistent entity that eventually en masse is going to rise up. And the sort of cataclysmic, the sort of crescendo of the protocols is a harbinger of Armageddon, is a harbinger of the ultimate battle between good and evil, which is kind of how it trails off at the end. It ends with a note of an almost apocalyptic note at the end. It's like the end of the, you know, we are preparing for the end of the world as we currently know it, so that the Jews can end up in ascendancy.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Neil Baldwin. He's the author of the new book, Henry Ford and the Jews, The Mass Production of Hate. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Neil Baldwin. He's the author of the new book, Henry Ford and the Jews, The Mass Production of Hate. It's about Henry Ford and anti-Semitism. What is known about who actually wrote the Protocols of the Elders of Zion?
In fact, very little is known. As a matter of fact, to this day, the actual authorship of the protocols is not known. What is known, there's two major facts that are known. One is that there's a school of thought that believes that the earlier iteration or roots for the protocols can be traced to the period in France known as the emancipation of, quote-unquote, emancipation of the Jews, which would be the late 18th century. There was an earlier document, a very similar document that was published back at that time. And the second iteration, which is the more concrete and longer-lasting one, came at about the cusp of the turn of the last century, or two centuries ago, 1897 to be exact. And that date happens to coincide with the first Zionist Congress, which took place in Basel, Theodor Herzl, and so forth, which is why many scholars believe that the Protocols of the Elders of Zion were put forth to cast aspersions on the Zionist movement. They were put forth as an antidote, or as an opposition to the Zionist movement, by an anonymous group of writers, anti-Semites, in Tsarist Russia.
Had the protocols spread much before Henry Ford published it, and what was the impact of his publication?
What happened was the articles in the Dearborn Independent, as I say, there were almost 100 of them, and starting in the fall of 1920, Ford began to anthologize these articles into four separate pamphlets. Each one had about 20, 25 articles in it. The pamphlets were called, had the overall headline of The International Jew, The World's Foremost Problem. And there were four of these little paperbacks, and they came out, you know, like every half a year over the ensuing couple of years that the articles were being printed in the Independent, so that if you missed any of them or if your subscription ran out, there were plenty of copies around. And what happened then was that the earliest publication, 1920, 1921, they found their way over to Germany, and they were published by Theodor Fritsch, who was a virulent anti-Semite in the very early 20s. Translated them into German, and they went through 21 printings in 1921 and 1922 alone. They took off like wildfire in Germany, in Munich especially.
So Henry Ford, in a way, helped stir up anti-Semitism in Germany.
If you were a visitor to Adolf Hitler's office in Munich, in the waiting room of Hitler's office, on a sort of low coffee table, was a sort of a display, like spread out, kind of fanned out across the table of the international Jew in the German versions, all the different pamphlets in a nice display so you could read them while you were waiting to see Hitler. And then when you were finally welcomed into the inner office, you would find a portrait of Henry Ford on the wall behind Hitler's desk. And this is 1922. This is 16 years before Kristallnacht, just to put that in historic perspective. Hitler was a very strong admirer of Henry Ford's ideology. He in Mein Kampf, he specifically gives credit and admiration to Henry Ford as being the only American. He says there was only one great American, Ford, who understands what we are trying to do here in Germany.
And while we're on the subject of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, although Henry Ford started printing that as long ago as 1920, that publication is still used by a lot of hate groups to justify their anti-Semitism.
It certainly is. The irony to me is that I don't think Henry Ford, but somebody, probably Liebold in Henry Ford's office, had the editorial sagacity, or maybe public relations sagacity, to break it up into little digestible chunks and put one into each issue of the newspaper. So it was like the entree into the articles against the Jews. You had to sort of move through the protocols. You had to become indoctrinated to the protocols to get to the actual editorial content of the newspaper.
How did Jewish groups respond to Ford's anti-Semitism and the anti-Semitic tracts that he was publishing?
The dialectical nature of this problem was what first sucked me into the exploration in the first place. I felt, as you've just implied, I felt that how would the Jewish leadership go up against somebody of this popularity and this clout, this household name, this brand, actually, human brand in a sense. How to deal with Ford came down to this very essential problem. Do you go up against him in a very aggressive, public way, i.e. petitions, boycotting the purchase of Ford automobiles, letter-writing campaign, telegraphing him, etc.? Do you take the public aggressive view, or, as Jacob Schiff, the elder statesman of the Jewish community, recommended at the time, do you assume that Ford is a lunatic, quote unquote, and that, quote, this will pass? And as Jacob Schiff advised his colleagues very strongly, if we go up against Henry Ford, I think he wrote in a letter, this will light a fire that will never be extinguished in our lifetime. We must allow him to essentially burn out and not dignify him with opposition in any way. That was the huge quandary that the American Jewish community faced when Henry Ford started publishing those articles.
Did either side win, or were there different responses from different groups?
Well, the interesting thing there is that the inspiration came from a non-Jew, a man named John Spargo, who was a social activist. He was very involved in the Settlement House movement in New York City. And John Spargo was an Englishman. He wasn't even American. He rallied hundreds of names for a petition against Ford that was finally published in the New York Times and the Herald Tribune and many other newspapers in early 1921, calling upon Ford, on behalf of our Jewish brethren, we implore you, Mr. Ford, to cease this adverse argumentative posture and to allow our Jewish brethren to live in peace in America. And as soon as that effort came from the social activist movement, Jane Addams and others, he reacted in a way that everybody feared he would. He reinvigorated the Articles campaign. He started going after specific Jews that he felt, quote, needed to be educated, unquote. I mean, his attack escalated as a result of being contradicted.
Neil Baldwin is the author of Henry Ford and the Jews, The Mass Production of Hate. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And by Dell Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of The Peddler's Grandson, Growing Up Jewish in Mississippi by Edward Cohen, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, David Bianculli reviews the new PBS documentary Mark Twain by filmmaker Ken Burns. Also, Henry Ford's public apology for his anti-Semitism and the story behind it. We continue our conversation with Neil Baldwin, author of Henry Ford and the Jews.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Neil Baldwin, author of Henry Ford and the Jews, The Mass Production of Hate. It investigates how one of America's greatest industrialists also became one of its most virulent anti-Semites. While he was producing the Model T, Henry Ford was using the newspaper he owned to publish excerpts of the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, which purported to be the notes of a secret meeting of Jews conspiring to take over the world. Neil Baldwin is the author of earlier biographies of Thomas Alva Edison and William Carlos Williams. He's the executive director of the National Book Foundation, which administers the National Book Awards. How did Ford's public display of anti-Semitism end?
Finally, in the summer of 1927, there was a libel suit brought against Ford in federal district court in Detroit by a man named Aaron Shapiro, who was a former rabbi and an attorney from California, who had actually launched the collective bargaining farming movement in America. He was a pioneer in educating farmers to get together and act in solidarity and help them raise prices and control the flow of their products and so forth. When Ford got wind of Aaron Shapiro's activities, he ordered a series of slanderous articles against him as a Jew daring to infiltrate farming and agriculture, which was a complete anathema to him. And Ford was sued by Shapiro, and the trial commenced, and Ford's lieutenants were called to the stand, and slowly the testimony unfurled, the attribution of Ford being, quote-unquote, the spark plug of the Jewish series, the fact that even though he hadn't written these articles himself, he was the instigation, it was his money, it was his ideas, it was his philosophy. And on the brink of being called to the stand himself, Ford issued a retraction, an apology to the Jewish people, which was drafted by Lewis Marshall, the head of the American Jewish Committee. It was published in hundreds of newspapers through the Hearst Syndicate throughout the country. And Ford, you know, essentially settled out of court with Shapiro rather than have to go up and actually talk himself about what he had or had not been doing. And the headline in the Jewish Daily Forward the next day, the banner headline was something to the effect of "Collapse of Anti-Semitism in America. Anti-Semitism is no more. Ford has fallen. The giant, you know, Goliath has fallen." And the Jewish leadership, of course, I think, in retrospect, I think their sigh of relief was premature, because Ford, within a couple of months, was going around saying that he never apologized for anything, and he still was going to, quote-unquote, get those Jews one way or another.
So when Henry Ford issued his retraction, a retraction that was actually written by a leader in the Jewish community, what did the retraction say?
The narrative of the retraction is as if he's saying, first of all, I unwittingly cast aspersions on the general populace of Jews. I didn't really mean to create such a furor by these unprovoked reflections. He admitted that the pamphlets had been distributed in other countries, and he said that those now had his, quote, unqualified disapproval, and that henceforth there would be no more writings against the Jews in the Dearborn Independent. These are points that Lewis Marshall, as an attorney, was trying to score. And once he found out that Ford was going to allow whatever he wrote to be published, he went ahead and covered as many bases as he could. The historical fact of the matter is that the major premise of this apology, which was the cessation of any further publication, did nothing, of course, to prevent the dissemination of everything that had come before. And Ford actually promised that he would no longer allow the Protocols or the International Jew to be published with his name on it. But since it was never copyrighted by him or by Liebold or Cameron, there was no way that he could enforce that. That's a very important point.
So the protocols continued to be published, continued to be spread around the world, in spite of Henry Ford's repudiation.
That's right.
Why would one of America's leading Jewish lawyers write a retraction on behalf of one of America's greatest anti-Semites?
Louis Marshall, after 7 or 8 years of agonizing and trying many different ways of countermanding Ford, you have to realize that Louis Marshall represented a huge constituency at the American Jewish Committee. He tried to get a meeting with Ford. He tried to send emissaries to meet with him on his behalf, and they were turned down. He tried organizing a letter-writing campaign that was ignored. So when intermediaries finally came to Louis Marshall and said, "We want you to draft this on his behalf," he leapt at the chance. He leapt at the opportunity to put what he thought was definitive closure on the matter. And he exercised all of his legal rhetoric and abilities and applied himself to it and felt like he was scoring a major victory for his people. He was very, very enthusiastic and very optimistic, as it turned out, falsely optimistic, because I think he wanted to put an end to this thing once and for all. And he thought that this was the brass ring, and he just went for it.
So 1927 is a big year for Ford. It's the year that he issues this retraction for his anti-Semitism. It's also the year that he ends production of the Model T.
Absolutely right. And the point that I think is worth cogitating is at the time Ford made his apology, he knew that he was going to be ceasing the Model T, but also bringing in a new model, the Model A, at around Christmas time. Right before he issued his apology, Ford called a couple of his close associates to his home, and he said to them, "You know, we're going to start that production on that new car pretty soon." And he implied very strongly, he didn't come right out and like connect the apology to the economics of anti-Semitism, but the timing of it is hard to avoid thinking, because of the timing, that it was very important for Ford to back off his virulence against the Jews before he decided to phase in the new car. As it was, he was getting tremendous competition from General Motors, and he was feeling kind of up against the wall to begin with. So I think the apology goes hand in hand with Ford's sense of running his company in a profitable way.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Neil Baldwin. He's the author of the new book, Henry Ford and the Jews, The Mass Production of Hate. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Neil Baldwin. He's the author of the new book, Henry Ford and the Jews, The Mass Production of Hate. And it's about the car manufacturer who it published a lot of anti-Semitic tracts and was quite anti-Semitic. Were there many Jews who worked for Ford at his production plants?
Ford had a very paternal, on the surface, Ford's behavior as a captain of industry, I found very appealing when I first got into it. He had he raised the hourly wage, the daily wage for workers in his factory to an unprecedented $5 a day at a time when most American workers were making half than that or less. He provided housing for his workers. He absolutely did hire immigrants and people from other cultures to work in his factories. However, he had a very strict and very rigorous and very invasive Americanization program. He actually sponsored an Americanization school. So, indeed, you could be a Jew and be hired by Henry Ford. However, you would be forced to take classes in not only English language, but etiquette, behavior. You would have to dress in a certain way. You would have to agree to certain rules in the way that you lived, in the way you conducted your life. No boarders could be taken into your home. Married men were preferred over the unmarried because supposedly their moral fiber was stronger. And so there's two sides to every story, and I think Ford probably decided that if you were going to be a Jew and work for him, then you'd have to conform to his very rigorous moral standards.
He actually had a sociological department. You described the workers in that department as part social workers, part detectives. What did they do?
Well, that's what I'm saying. They would, let's say you were working for Ford, you would have to be ready to see one of these members of the sociological department could end up on your doorstep at any time of the day or night to sort of check up on you, make sure that you were sticking to the straight and narrow path. He also had questionnaires and exams that he would administer to his workers, asking them very basic facts of American history, which is interesting considering that one of Ford's most famous homilies is history is more or less the bunk. However, he didn't always practice what he preached, and he had a very, very strong jingoistic streak. I think that also fed into his Jew bias because he had a lot of trouble associating with people who he felt were different in any way. And it was very hard if you were associated with Ford or you socialized with him and you would go to his home after dinner. It was very hard to avoid being drawn into an anti-Semitic conversation. It was really part of his daily discourse.
You know, although after the trial that you discussed, Ford stopped publishing his anti-Semitic tracts, his anti-Semitic influence didn't end there. Would you talk a little bit about what Ford's influence was and what Ford's financial interests were in Nazi Germany?
Hitler sent an emissary to America in the early years before he had even ascended to full power of the Reich. He sent an emissary to this country named Kurt Ludeke, essentially a fundraiser for the Reich, and he instructed him to be sure and pay a call on Henry Ford. This was in the early 1920s. And Ludeke came to Detroit, and he was able to get a private meeting with Henry Ford. And Ford denied subsequent to that he ever gave funding directly to Nazi Germany or to Adolf Hitler. I think that Ford's support of Hitler is ideological rather than financial. In my research, I was not able to uncover any paper trail directly leading to Hitler from Ford with a financial edge to it. Now, that being said, Henry Ford knew very early on that Germany was a rich, could be a rich potential source for his company. In 1924 and 1925, he already had a factory in place in Berlin and was producing cars over there. And about 5 or 6 years later, the major Ford plant in Cologne was in operation. And there's no question that for about 15-year period there, Fords were a popular brand in Germany leading up to World War II. That, and again, I must qualify that by saying that many American companies were participating in the economy of Germany at that time. And it's ironic because General Motors actually had a much larger share of the market for the first decade or so that the American car companies had a presence in Germany. Starting in the earliest years of World War II, however, Ford began to produce materiel and trucks and jeeps and vehicles of a more useful nature to the Germans.
What has Ford done since the death of Henry Ford to make amends for all of the anti-Semitism that Henry Ford was responsible for?
As soon as Henry Ford II took over the chairmanship of the company, which is 1945, Hank the Deuce, as he was known, as he was called by Lee Iacocca and others, he immediately issued various statements and declarations, public pronouncements about the Ford Motor Company position on Jews and its philosophy of equality for all people. And Ford, as a company, was one of the most ardent supporters of the nascent and emerging state of Israel, financially, in terms of producing cars over there. And in the 5 or 6 decades since then, there's no question that the Ford family and the Ford Motor Company has no trace of the legacy of its founder. This was something that began with Henry Ford and ended with Henry Ford. There's no question in my mind about that.
Did you wonder a lot while you were writing your book, Henry Ford and the Jews, how it was possible for somebody to be so smart when it came to his industry and so incredibly insane when it came to Jews?
Yes. But then again, I go back to, I found in all the large figures that which I tend to want, you know, I have a compulsion to approach these large figures. I keep thinking of Whitman's phrase, you know, do I contradict myself? Very well, then I contradict myself. I really do think that large figures with large egos have some kind of self-administered license to range widely in whatever field they want to and say and do whatever they want. Many, many people who were interviewed after Ford's death about his behavior used a lot of the same language in terms of describing his tendency to barge into areas where he didn't know anything. Why wouldn't he just stick with making cars? People would say, friends of his and visitors and admirers of his would say, you know, and even Theodore Roosevelt said at one point something to the effect that Henry Ford should stay out there at the factory making these cars one after another, cheap and, you know, durable cars. As soon as he steps off that factory grounds and starts to, you know, run for president or publish newspapers or make pronouncements about the war, he blunders. He makes mistakes. But no one could go up to Henry Ford and say, you know, just stay out there at the factory. I mean, he wouldn't listen to that. So I think he had he gave himself the license to do that. He was quite delusional about his own correctness about things.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Neil Baldwin is the author of Henry Ford and the Jews, The Mass Production of Hate. Coming up, David Bianculli reviews Ken Burns' new documentary on Mark Twain. This is Fresh Air. Tonight and tomorrow night, PBS presents the latest documentary directed by Ken Burns, a two-night, four-hour biography called Mark Twain. TV critic David Bianculli has this preview.
Ken Burns makes two kinds of documentaries. There's the epic, the giant narratives that take years to make and weeks to watch, like the Civil War, baseball, and jazz. And there are the smaller studies, biographies of such people as Thomas Jefferson and Lewis and Clark, which can be absorbed in a couple of sittings. Mark Twain, shown tonight and tomorrow night by PBS, is one of the small ones. Yet in subject and execution, it's one of the biggest of the small ones. If you're very familiar with the life of Samuel Clemens and the works of his literary alter ego Mark Twain, you're bound to be impressed. If you don't know all that much, especially about his life, you're likely to be amazed. Mark Twain, directed by Burns, is written by Dayton Duncan and Jeffrey C. Ward and produced by Duncan and Burns. They've designed this documentary as a sort of dual biography. There's the creation and success of Mark Twain, the stand-up comic and celebrity author, and there's the astoundingly traveled and tragic life of Sam Clemens, who became famous writing sarcastic travel dispatches from Europe and the Pacific. Over his lifetime, Clemens made and lost several fortunes and buried almost all of his loved ones while writing some of the best and bravest works of American literature. This happens to be a subject I'm especially passionate about, so I can't say I learned many new facts from this documentary. I could also nitpick, if I wanted, about a photo or two being shown years too early in the program's chronology, or complain about some of Twain's writings that were quoted too briefly or not at all. I'm not even fully sold on Kevin Conway, who provides the voice of Mark Twain. Yet I love what this Mark Twain study does, which is to make the man's work and life truly come alive. If it doesn't make you want to pick up one of his books and dive in, then you're not paying attention. Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Twain's masterpiece, is handled especially well here. It's given the literary weight it deserves, and the historical weight, and even the ethical weight. Many people comment enthusiastically about Mark Twain and Sam Clemens in this biography. Russell Banks and Ron Powers are major standouts. But the best expert, by far, is Hal Holbrook. Holbrook, of course, has played Mark Twain in his one-man show for about half a century now, constantly revising the program and revisiting Twain's works, letters, and biographies. Yet for this PBS program, he doesn't play Mark Twain. He explains him. With so much insight and enthusiasm, you can't help but be as excited and impressed as Holbrook is. When Holbrook talks about Huckleberry Finn, for example, he talks very specifically about why and when Twain's planned sequel to the children's book Tom Sawyer became something much more serious. During a trip by Twain to revisit his roots, to recall his days as a riverboat pilot on the Mississippi and a boy growing up in Missouri, Holbrook says the author and the manuscript were profoundly affected.
Lincoln declared the Emancipation Proclamation to try to idealize the struggle of the North against the South. And then in 1876, Reconstruction died, the Ku Klux Klan came out, and Huckleberry Finn, the book, began. Interesting. He started to write this thing, and he must have run into difficulty. Interesting. And then he stops the book. He put it aside for 5 years. Then in April 1882, he decides to go down the river to New Orleans on a steamboat and write a book called Life on the Mississippi, not Huckleberry Finn. In May, he turns around, he starts back up the river again, all the way to Minnesota. And then at the tag end of that, he goes back and visits Hannibal again. And the next month, what does he do? He picks up Huckleberry Finn. What does that say to you? What did he see going down that river? He'd been off that river for 20 years, since before the Civil War. What do you think he was looking at? He was looking at the horrible failure of freeing the slave.
That sort of passion, to me, is impossible to resist. Tonight's first half of Mark Twain ends with the publication of Huckleberry Finn, and you might want to have a copy of the book by your bedside so you can dive right in. Meanwhile, tomorrow night's conclusion offers many more masterworks, many more insights, and many more tragedies. Like almost every project Burns tackles, Mark Twain turns out to be quite a bit about race. This latest biography isn't a departure from the Civil War. In many ways, it's a companion volume and a sequel.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive director is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shirok directs the show. I'm Tyria Gross.
Tapes and transcripts of most Fresh Air programs are available by calling 877-21-FRESH or 877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actress Cate Blanchett. She stars as a spy behind enemy lines in the new World War II film Charlotte Gray. She's also now in The Shipping News and Lord of the Rings. I'm Tyria Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.